Hello, and welcome to a very special episode of AgTech So What, brought to you by the AgVentic Group. I'm Sarah Nolette. We're very pleased to say that this is our 100th episode, and what a journey it's been from idea to what I genuinely feel has become a global AgTech community. So for this episode, we're doing something different. We're going to hear from you, our listeners, about the future of the AgTech industry. We'll also hear from some of our most popular guests about what they've been up to and where the future of the ag tech industry, in particular regenerative ag and soil carbon, is headed. Because while this podcast has grown, so too has the entire space. And that's what it's all about, ultimately. Every conversation and story is about trying to move the needle. So, have we?
My bullshit antennas even got even higher and at a even more attuned than it was. As soon as I hear someone talking about Mother Nature, my antenna just starts to sparkle up and I'm going, oh my God, what's coming behind this is something a bit dangerous.
That is the thing that is becoming transformative, is that people are striding into supply chains, striding into retail, striding into seed or chemical or these other big places and saying, I'm smart and capable and an asset to this company, and I'm going to hold them accountable to doing better. And to me, that's a super hopeful story.
You just heard from Sarah Mock, agriculture journalist and author. And before that, Mark Wooten, known in Australia as the carbon neutral farmer. We'll be checking in on what's happened since we last spoke to them and where they think ag tech is headed. We'll also hear from Stuart Austin from Wilmot Cattle Company, which has recently been in the news for selling carbon credits to Microsoft. And we get an update from Derek Norman, VP of Venture Investments at Leaps by Bayer. I couldn't do all of this alone today or any other day, so it seems fitting to also bring in our producer, Kirsten, or as we call her, K-Dips. So where should we start, K-Dips?
Hey, happy 100th, Sarah.
Oh, that makes me feel old.
You're not old, but you've been here from the beginning, which it's been a few years, I think, since you began, maybe 4 or 5. And I'd actually like to ask you about the early days of the podcast later. Just because you're always talking about iterating. So I think 100 episodes is a pretty decent milestone. And I also thought it might be fun to pull out one of your early iterations.
Ooh, do we have to?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's an interesting intro that I think will be fun to play. The pod even had a different name when you started.
Yes, it was called Bush Tech.
Ah, yeah. Okay. But it was the intro music, I think, that was absolute gold. And we're going to share it at the end of the episode.
Great. Well, looking forward to that. In the meantime, let's bring in Mark Wooten. He is a mixed farmer in Hamilton, Victoria, who has really been a pioneer for carbon neutral farming, which is why his comments on regenerative ag last year on the podcast were so surprising.
Well, I'm an atheist when it comes to regen ag. I think that is an evangelical movement. And I think that they need to come up with the science, and they keep coming, and I keep saying, send me the science that shows me, peer-reviewed science that shows me the outcome, and not one of them has produced it yet, not one.
So what's changed? Has he been sent the science? I caught up with Mark to find out.
Well, just on a practical level on the farm, we've had quite good seasons compared to other parts of the world, and we're producing, and we've got probably record protein prices for both most of our meat products, so lamb, mutton and beef. On another level, I'm the deputy chair of Victorian Agricultural Climate Change Council, which is a state government-based organisation, and we are looking across the whole ag sector in Victoria and trying to identify potential issues coming up, but more importantly, in terms of climate change opportunities.
And what's the conversation like in terms of climate advocacy? Like, I guess my sense is there's been a bit of a tipping point. I don't know if it's COVID and people have been doing more navel gazing or bushfires. Do you feel like things are accelerating?
I feel like on an individual, on a community, on a corporate basis, it definitely is moving. The recent IPCC report that just came out has just highlighted the fact that we're going to get to where we didn't want to get to about 10 years earlier. It's just in broad language, we're going to hell in a handbasket and we need to actually start acting. So farmers are very, very attuned to risk and they're looking at this as an opportunity to make sure that they minimise their risk. And it's a good space to be, actually. I have very little debates about climate change and whether humans are causing it anymore. It's just virtually a non-topic. It's just, okay, let's not worry about that, but what can we do? It's all focused on future.
That's super exciting. I mean, that's been my sense too, but I sometimes think I'm kind of preaching to the choir a little bit. Are you seeing that around adoption of technology as well, as people are less skeptical maybe of climate and seeing this as a threat, risk, but also an opportunity?
I think it's happening. I mean, I'm involved in I chair a little independent panel for the Vic government on basically energy reduction, which is a lot of it's about renewables. And it's a $60 million program, so it's a useful one. It's oversubscribed, and farmers have got to that point where they've got the neighbour or the case study up the road they can go look at, someone who's adopted, whether it's a, you know, more efficient irrigation pump, or they've moved into solar, or they're looking at whatever the systems are they're operating in, and they're just taking it up. And it's a 50-50 scheme, so they have to put their half their own money in. And the adoption in that is just, it's just accelerating. Now they're going to run out of money again. So it's a good, you know, it just shows you people are voting with their feet.
Our view, and we covered this on the bonus podcast we just put out and a blog we wrote, the incentives don't fully align in terms of who benefits. And a lot of this will come from pull in the supply chain. If you've got a meat processor offering, you know, different grid prices for something that can prove certain environmental outcomes, or if you've got incentives downstream in the supply chain to adopt technology that makes you more efficient, et cetera, that can be another, I guess, leverage point, not just kind of 50-50 matching from government. So hopefully we'll see more of those private sector and supply chain incentives coming too.
And I think that's the key. It can't be, you know, the government can't involve themselves overly in it other than act as a lead, you know, and show by example. And I think that, you know, if you look at meat quality as an issue of purchasing, that's where it's happening. And that's what will happen, I think, with the carbon footprint stuff. And the meat processors have seen that the consumer wants to have eating quality. And so therefore they've set up the grid accordingly and the testing, so you can trace individual carcasses going through different plants. And that's all just taking off, and people are going, oh my God, I never realized that we could do this. And now there's momentum because people want to go, and they, you know, if you're spending a lot of money on a product, they want to have a guaranteed, you know, outcome when they put it into their own household situation.
When you came on the podcast, Mark, I definitely don't think I expected this, but the episode we did was one of the most popular episodes that we've ever done. Nothing against you, but I just wasn't sure how ready the market was for a focus on regenerative agriculture. And I was blown away by the response. And your episode in particular, I think, struck a chord with people because of how you farm and who you are and your success, and yet your skepticism over the term regen. What was the response you received after coming on the podcast? Did you get any feedback?
Well, if you were surprised, Sarah, I was even more surprised, because I had there was the climate chorus, as I call them. They came forward and were very sympathetic and keen that we do things that we do. But I also had a number of anxious people, I'll put it that way, contacted me about some of the might have been a bit hard on regen, having to put some science behind their claims. And of those people who did contact me, a few did say they were going to send me data, and none have. So I'm still back where I was. There's a data vacuum in this spot. My to be crude with you, my bullshit antennas even got even higher, and at a even more attuned than it was. As soon as I hear someone talking about Mother Nature, my antenna just starts to sparkle up, and I'm going, oh my God, what's coming behind this is something a bit dangerous. And that doesn't mean I'm not looking at it critically, and I'm not anti the concept of regenerative. It's sort of like, it's a beautiful phrase. I just think it's been co-opted in different ways. I mean, I think it's moved in a much more positive direction now, though. I think there's a lot more data and people doing it. I think some of the cases that have come forward, unfortunately, like the Wilmont Ag, where Microsoft bought in and stuff, unfortunately, that seems to be a bit not properly verified. And there's a whole scientific discussion going on about that. So I get papers on this as well. So I'm getting belted from all sides on it. The message I really would be like people to take home is that you're still better doing something, even if it's not perfect, than doing nothing. And that's why I would still, even with my bullshit antenna very heightened, I still would rather them be working in this space than going back and doing nothing. So I don't want to be as negative as perhaps I was in that podcast.
Sarah, I feel like at this point it would be really good to bring in Stuart Austin. He's the general manager of Wilmot Cattle Company, who Mark just actually mentioned then. And you happened to also interview him for this podcast.
Yes. Well, first, I spoke to him back in 2019. And this year, there's been some big news for Wilmot, as I said before, where they announced that they're selling $500,000 worth of soil carbon credits to Microsoft in what was a pretty landmark deal.
Yeah, it's huge. I mean, just to think, a farm in New South Wales, and granted, it's a very professional operation. It's owned by the MacDoc Group, but it means that farmers can actually sell carbon credits to a company like Microsoft. It's a big deal.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where we started this conversation when I caught up again with Stu.
There certainly has been a lot that's gone on in the last couple of years. So it's been exciting. I mean, yeah, 2019 was a pretty tough year in terms of fires and droughts and destocking and kind of just, in some respects, idling along waiting for the good times. And that'll happen in January, February 2020, things changed considerably, started to rain, and we really cranked things up and got back to business as usual, I suppose, over, you know, in that 2020 year. And then towards the back end of 2020 was when things started to transpire around our carbon credit deal. It was sort of all happening in the background, I suppose. And then, as you well know, early this year, that deal was announced through the Regen network with Microsoft. And so that led to the first 6 months of this year, my life was basically consumed by soil carbon talking, and a lot of discussions and a lot more talking, which was terrific. I mean, that was one of the big reasons we did that deal was, yes, there was a financial gain in there for us, but it was also around, you know, the rubber hitting the road and someone getting a deal done relating to soil carbon and the world recognising that soil carbon was a real thing and very valuable and had a lot to offer in terms of opportunity for landholders, not only in Australia, but around the world. And how we need to consider integrating technology or the use of technology into soil carbon measurement. It was really exciting, man, just to see how the whole conversation just escalated so dramatically over the last 6 months in terms of, you know, now there's all kinds of players coming into the market on all different fronts and people coming to market with different measurement and modeling, you know, methods using technology. And I think it's just fantastic.
Yeah. It's kind of one thing to be first, like the expression that comes to mind is you want to be on the leading edge, not the bleeding edge, but some might argue that you're on the bleeding edge for some of this stuff in kind of an experimental field. What do you say when others ask you, you know, is it ready? Should they get involved? Can other farmers sell credits to Microsoft?
Yeah, look, it is. And we do, I suppose, deflect to the EIRF model as being, you know, when people are at the start of the journey and in terms of the grazing management journey, so they're just, that practice change is just starting, you know, we'd say the best thing for you to do is, yes, to talk to one of the carbon developers, project developers, and see, get them to do that desktop analysis and study and scoping analysis on your farm, because every farm is different, and see what opportunity there might be, because once you start on the grazing management journey, then that's when the upside starts. So the more of that upside you can capture and the sooner you can start the project, the sooner you'll be able to capture that upside. So that existing model is already there. What we did, yes, it was the first that Regen had ever done. It was the first soil carbon credit Microsoft had ever bought. It was the first significant soil carbon credit that had been traded, you know, at scale. In some respects, it's not necessarily a downside, but the downside to us now is that we're locked into that. We're committed to that methodology, that program with the Regen network. You know, there's a whole bunch of complexities around the fact that even though we registered these two farms under the ERF model, now that we've sold carbon off these farms under a different model, they have to be removed from that ERF project for a whole bunch of different reasons. So in some respects, we've kind of tied our hands a bit, but on the plus side, it just means that we work really closely with the Regen network to continue to improve the rigor and the accuracy and the integrity of their methodology. So, which means bringing in other technology, other models, et cetera, whatever we can get our hands on.
One of the things you said is that you've now become a pretty hot commodity in terms of speaking about this stuff and getting asked to share your journey. What's that been like for you? Do you ever feel like you're doing more talking than farming? And do you like talking?
I think you know me pretty well now, Sarah. I don't mind a yarn. I'm very passionate about sharing our story. And yes, by default, I've become kind of our MacDoc ad group spokesperson. But I suppose I've do it reasonably well, and I do really enjoy it, and I really enjoy the fact that it helps other people, you know, and the messages that I get or the phone calls that I get, you know, Stu, can I just have you only about this, and I've got all the time in the world to do that, because we don't do that enough as an industry. We don't pick up the phone and ask a mate for, you know, for some intel or some help or advice. So yeah, it's been great. And as we've said all along, this is an additional revenue stream. We're not stopping food production and starting carbon production. We're continuing food production. That carbon is still in our soil on this farm. We have just a major corporate business that needs to offset their emissions has said, we really like that story and the fact that you are taking that carbon out of the atmosphere and we'd like to buy that credit from you. So we still get all the benefits from the carbon in our soil. So that's been a real positive, I think. You know, it was only in the last couple of months, I suppose, that evolved.
Back when you came on the podcast in 2019, we did talk about regenerative agriculture and the kind of stigma that exists or existed and how it was moving, I guess, from witchcraft to solid business practices. I guess, does that stigma still exist?
No, I think the momentum's continuing to grow, and particularly coming out of the drought, there was a huge increase in interest, I suppose. And, you know, I've always said that pain, one of the greatest catalysts for change is pain. You know, you read anyone's miracle story, it was a bloody life-threatening event that led to them performing miracles. And so that's what happened to a bloody big portion of the industry. They came out of the drought and they went, holy shit, I do not ever want to go through that again. Tell me a different way. Tell me how you got through it without feeling like we did or ending up like we did. So it has been fantastic. Everyone's got, there's such a broad spectrum of theories around regenerative agriculture, what it is, what it means, how you do it, practices versus principles, et cetera, et cetera. But certainly, I think the recognition is growing, you know, as to how important it is that we focus on soil health from a biological perspective. Yes, the carbon piece has certainly added some weight to that. People are kind of putting the two and two together a bit now.
That's one thing that regen ag skeptics want to see is where's the data, where's the science, and, you know, what can you really point to in this space? How do you answer that question?
We've got it all, and I'm more than willing to show people that, demonstrate that. There's certainly not much of our business that we haven't put out in the public or in a public forum. And the other thing that I try really hard not to do is create that really confrontational discussion around regen ag. You know, it's here's what we do. We're sharing this to help other people. Take it or leave it. I don't mind if you don't believe in it. That's fine. All the best. I'm not offended by people who, and I just don't get in those polarizing discussions. And when I do, I say, that's okay. No dramas. That's fine. You continue to manage the way you do. I've got no qualms with that. And which comes back to, you can't help those who don't want to be helped. And if people aren't interested, but that's fine.
Yeah. You talked a little bit about it last time when you came on the podcast in terms of using grazing management software with Maya Grazing, any other tech that you've been using to collect that data and do that, you know, make sure it is rigorous.
Well, the regen network stuff, that was all Sentinel imagery stuff that I still don't fully understand, but do to some extent. And we probably built on that, I suppose, with FarmLab, with Sam Duncan. We've just started to use his platform, plugging all our data. You know, we've got so much data, particularly soil data now, and it started to be measured by, you know, CarbonLink, and RCS took some samples. And so we've got all these soil samples, and it has to this point been housed in a real big beast of a spreadsheet of Bart that can do all sorts of great things, and he can drive it and I can drive it and not many others can. But all that other data that we've also been collecting, I sort of wanted to put it in one place and then expand on that with some of that mapping capability, you know, and that's what I think is exciting, is being able to extrapolate that analysis out across the whole farm using some of those different satellite imagery tools.
You mentioned before that you're sort of being seen as a carbon farmer now. Is there any downside to being seen as a carbon farmer when, again, that's just one aspect of your business? As you said before, you're still producing food and even carbon's not your main commodity.
Yep. It's interesting. I've got somewhat of a template for a presentation nowadays, and that is one line in there is that we don't call ourselves carbon farmers. You know, our guys get out of bed every day to think about how they can grow more grass, produce more kilos of beef and make more money from beef production. That's their primary focus. So, and that's why we always talk about this, the carbon credit as an additional revenue stream and a co-benefit of our beef production business. So, yeah, plenty of people call us carbon farmers. I suppose that's where we, like I said earlier, we're kind of building a bit of an understanding of the difference between what we've done versus what, say, guys in Western New South Wales or Western Queensland are doing with human-induced re-veg projects or those other sort of carbon methodologies that's where the majority of ACCUs have been generated to this point. And for the most part, those guys are making more money from carbon than they are from protein production, I suppose, where we're sort of saying, no, our production business is still as it was. We're also laying on top of that an additional revenue stream through soil carbon credits.
Well, there's more than one way to skin a cat when it comes to carbon.
Yeah, it's such an early field, but super exciting. And both Stuart and Mark Wooten are pioneers in what they're doing. While they do have a different approach, I'd say they probably have more similarities than they do differences.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. And they've really started a conversation that's just become more mainstream, certainly within Australia and beyond. I mean, after our podcast with Mark Wooten, he then appeared on a documentary done by the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. It was called Fight for Planet A.
Yeah, so I actually asked him about this and he received an interesting response from the public.
Well, I foolishly said on that show, if you want to have a guilt-free steak, we'll sell you one. And we had a litany of very well-meaning, very thoughtful consumers that must have found our webpage and then wrote to us saying, where do we get a steak from you? And we had to write back and say, that's not how we do it. It's not the scalable. But again, I'm hoping that I'm wrong on that. And in the future, we can. You know, the supply chain and exactly what you're touching on before actually allows for market differentiation from our sheep or lamb or beef as it goes through that mainstream process. And we're getting rewarded accordingly. And hopefully the retailer gets rewarded accordingly too. And that's where we've got to make sure that we do it. Interestingly enough, going back to the Wilmot example, one of the key things that's happened since that for me going forward is putting aside the whole debate about regen and verification and permanence, and which is a debate with them, but let's just put all that to one side for the moment. I think farmers need to critically think about whether they are going to sell their carbon credits to third party or they're going to keep them for their own product, particularly at lower rates. I think that is a really commercial decision they have to focus on. And for some, it's a logical thing that they do it now. And for others like us, we're not selling. We're keeping it to us. We will not be able to say we have a carbon neutral product if we sell them off to third parties to offset their own emissions.
Yeah. I mean, there's a big question there around, I mean, the input companies now want to claim these offsets and do that through the farmers they supply. The downstream companies want to do it through the farmers they procure from. The farmers are going to have to claim some kind of carbon neutrality. And like, you know, there's only so many credits to go around. And then to your point about all the other risks, I'm not at all advocating for doing nothing, but like you said, sort of thinking about this space and the evolution versus maybe some of the people coming knocking on the door saying you can make a quick buck. It's pretty challenging to actually make a decision.
And where do you draw the line? We say our line's at our farm gate when the product leaves, because that's where our control ends. And that's the sheep sustainability framework that comes out has worked on that from an animal welfare perspective. It's worked on that from a carbon. It's worked on it from an enviro point of view. If that's the line, because then each the party's transport or the processors or the retail end have to be responsible for their own element. That's a complicated story to say to consumers though. But people are getting their head around this, that if you do sell off your carbon credits now to third parties, you can't sell it. It's barley. You can only sell your barley once. You can't sell it twice. And that's the analogy I use. The other thing which is quite critical going forward in terms of farmers is that they need to be conscious that as they get better at their production system and they lower their footprint, maybe to carbon positive, they can sell some to third parties. But they need to have better measurement within their own systems. And that's really challenging because of the, you know, vagaries of, you know, the biggest thing with the carbon soil change is predominantly you can really match it on rainfall levels. So those who've had good years, all of a sudden their carbon changes dramatically. And so it's terrifying because the market, you know, the market know this and then consumers know that. The risk is they'll go, this is all too hard. I'm not doing any of it because they're all crooks and we'll all be painted with the same brush. And that's one of the reasons I'm probably quite critical of parties that are involved, because it's my credibility could be attacked as being a farmer in general if some farmers do dodgies on the side.
Yeah, I think that's right. We've talked about a few solutions, so technology, kind of supply chain incentives, government. What else needs to change in the conversation in Australia or globally around ag and climate change?
Well, I still think the consumer has a really powerful position to play. If they demand of the retailer that they want this product, which is certified, verifiable going forward, then I think you'll find that you will have more, that demand will drag it through the system. People will respond to price signals. They do. I mean, we won't be any different. If there's a price signal, we've signed up with ZQ, the New Zealand wool brand, which is mainly based on the sportswear market, you know, Icebreaker and that type of product. And they've now got an RX part of it, which is regen and carbon side on it. And we've got that. And they're going to use our own brand to talk about our biodiversities and that whole enviro story we've got, which is probably a significant, probably more significant to us than the carbon side, to be honest with you. You know, we just planted here physically, we just planted just over 24,000 trees into these linkages plantations just in the last month. And as soon as you get people engaged in this space, they start, my children and my, you know, all of their friends all came out and volunteered in, they're all in their 20s. They wanted to actively be involved in solutions. There's a lot of goodwill in this space. And we just need to make sure to give people hope. We don't want to just say the IPCC reports, you know, we're heading to hell in a handbasket, but you can't do anything about it. I mean, why would we keep doing what we're doing? Why would you keep doing what you're doing?
I do love a philosophical question, Sarah, because that's often what it comes down to. And one guest we had last year, I think, really spent her entire career asking, why am I doing what I'm doing?
Yes, Sarah Mock, who grew up on a farm in Wyoming, she's worked for some high-profile ag tech startups like Farmers Business Network, but has really made a name for herself as an ag journalist and an author with some pretty provocative but well-thought-out perspectives.
Yeah, and the thing about Sarah Mock is, like, her whole reason for writing is led by a mission to find out what's actually working in ag, what's making a difference, what's breaking down some of those traditional barriers. And just simply, what is a good farm? And I think people really like her because she's so brutally honest and really not worried about ruffling any feathers, but like you said, in a thought out way.
Yeah, that's right. She's not afraid to make a statement and not afraid to back them up and, you know, genuinely wants to move the conversation forward, all of which is pretty rare in this space. Since we last spoke to her, she's actually released a book called Farm and Other F-Words, which is all about what makes a small family farm work or not work so well. That's where I began my conversation with Sarah, asking her how the book release went.
It went amazing. I mean, I did a pre-release where I raised some funds to get to do the launch before, you know, 6 months or so before I actually published, and got a ton of support, which was very shocking and surprising to me. I still live in the world day to day where I assume that it's mostly just my parents reading everything I write. And when actual real people in the world show up to read it, it's very exciting.
Well, congratulations. Tell me another story. What's something that's happened as a result of writing the book that you're excited about?
Yeah, I mean, so many people have just like reached out to me and wanted to chat more about what they're working on, or I get asked a lot how farmers respond and react to the book, because there are some hot takes, I will say, within its pages. And you know, the thing is, I've been really surprised and excited to hear that a lot of farmers have actually been like, thank goodness that this book was written, because I appreciate this perspective a lot. And like, this is a part, there's so much basically like weird patriotic like jargon in the industry, and not enough of talking about just like, yeah, but it's not just about being tough and this being like a legacy business and it being about like feeding the world. It's also a business, and it's also entrepreneurship, and it's also tough and like all these other ways. And I think, you know, people in the book, people adjacent to the book read it and were like, oh my gosh, I feel so seen and validated. And that has been really great. And yeah, like they're more than just a symbol.
For sure. They're
real people.
I so appreciated the exploration of all the different kinds of farms. And I feel like it probably just because it echoed a bit of my personal journey in like, what is a farm? What is a good farm? How do we think about these different farms? And I could sort of visualize you, like, I'm sure it didn't actually happen in the linear way that it sort of unfolds in each chapter. I mean, it sounds like a quest that many of us, including yourself, are kind of still on to figure out, like, I mean, people talk about farmers. There's no one kind of farmer. There are many kinds of farms, and our view of what a good farm is and can be is shifting. Has your view, like where are you up to on your view of farms and good farms and big farm team?
Oh man, that is such a hard question, especially as I get into working on the second half of this book that's going to come out in late spring 2022. you know, it was fun. I was just talking the other day about how I, the only reason I started doing journalism and was basically because I had worked in the ag industry for a couple of years and I had really mixed feelings about the work I was doing and about whether or not it was impactful, whether or not it was the best use of my skills and about where the most important work in agriculture is. And I got into journalism to try and actually pay rent while I tried to answer those questions. And 5 years later, I don't know that I have great answers yet. And that's kind of discouraging because I just, one, like things are shifting really fast and people like new ideas are coming up and being explored. Like the number of farms that have started and failed within the time that I have been reporting on them is incredible and crazy and sad. And I have so many emotions about all that. So where am I in my journey of what is a farm and what it looks like? You know, I think I wrote the book and the kind of the big climax is just this idea of, you know, maybe if farms could learn some of the lessons that other places, entrepreneurial realms have learned, you know, things like your people are your most important asset or, you know, pursue profit, find opportunities, that those kind of ideas could be really transformative in agriculture and on farms in particular. And in the second book, going out and trying to find people who are already putting those kind of big team farm ideas into practice, there's not that many. If there's any, people are doing parts of it. Different people are doing different parts. And I think that's important. You know, there's certainly people who are pursuing that kind of a really strong kind of human community or environmental ethic. There's certainly people who are out there working really hard to empower their employees and to make them part of their systems. And there's certainly people who are out there who are being economically successful, which I think is a really key piece. I haven't really found anyone, or at least very few, who are able to tie those three things together. And I think that's been really important. It's been disappointing, I think, but also really important from a personal perspective for me of just like people like me, which I guess I'm like a bit of a theorist. And then also I think a lot of people who look to agriculture as, you know, a way to do social impact work or a way to do social impact investing want it to be all those things. And maybe it can't. Maybe it can't be all things to all people all the time. And maybe, you know, we need to have a really thoughtful conversation about what we give up when we like, what are the most important things and what might we actually be willing to give up with, or what might we be willing to pursue in a more limited way? And yeah, I think that is not where I was when I had just finished writing the first book, when I was like, no, big team farms are going to like change everything. It's going to be great and no worries. It's totally fine. And I think I've, at this point, having visited a bunch of farms that I had put in that category before and had a lot of really tough conversations with folks, I'm in a little bit more of a place of saying paradigm shifts are hard, change is hard, it takes a lot of energy, and I think we have a long road ahead.
Yes. And do you think we hold farms, I know this is a bigger question, but maybe quick comments, to, and why, if we do, like different standards than other businesses? It strikes me there's lots of reasons we don't think of them as businesses in the traditional sense. And so we kind of hold them to a different standard.
Totally. Yeah. And I think that plays to their advantage and to their disadvantage at different times. I mean, I think part of it is just like the fact that there's like such a strong interaction with nature and impact on nature. You know, I think that conversation gets really philosophical really fast of just like, maybe we can't harvest food from nature without damaging it, even though we really want to not damage it. I think we also let farms off a lot on it. I think on the other side too, like because of the way we've pastoralized and idealized farm work, we also make a lot of exceptions for farm work, which like it can be to farmers' advantage a lot because we're like, oh, you don't need to be paid to do that. It's so fun. It's so easy. It's so natural. It's so human. But on the other side, it's also because of the economics of the farm system we've set up that assumed all of that, those first things, we've created a system where it's actually very hard to respectfully create work with dignity that pays people well, that also leads to a product that is affordable to people. And, you know, and I think that that is the third piece is, oh, how much food is allowed to cost is like a whole part of this conversation and a whole part, like that is a society-wide question for us about like, is food a human right? Should people be allowed to starve to death, or should like food be something that we are entitled to? But at the same time, in practice, a lot of times, because we realize those unrealistic standards are there, we kind of just let farmers off the hook for everything. Because we're just like, oh, like, we don't know where to put the bar with those super unrealistic standards. So we just put it down at like, are you a farmer? Then you must be good.
Yes. I mean, the thing that comes to my head always is like good, fast, and cheap. And it's, those aren't the three things that you're putting on the end of those triangles, but like you can't have all of them. And we accept that in other areas of business, but exactly that in farming, we haven't quite figured out what is okay and what is the standard. When we spoke to you, I think it was your Twitter profile that said it, and we kind of framed the episode as making windows in the walls around agriculture. Has anything changed? Are there more windows now? Is ag as an industry shifting more diverse, more able to be criticized or introspective?
Yeah, you know, I'm just one person trying to like get a view of like this really enormous and complex thing. So I can only speak from my like very personal perspective, but the very cool thing about this whole process of writing the book, putting out the book, and then starting on the research for the second book was having the number of conversations I've had with folks who are working right now in the conventional ag industry. And it's just like young to mid-career, thoughtful folks who are working because we live in a capitalist society where you have to work to buy food and take care of your family, for these industries, for these companies, for these organizations that like they know have done evil things in the past. And they are there and ready to work to say like, listen, I am here to hold this place accountable. I'm here to work and to do good things in the world. And to, you know, when a big company says, oh, we have a sustainability agenda now, or we're going to do, you know, we're going to set up a data program, but it's not going to be exploitative of farmers. There is this new wave, or this wave of young people and workers in this space that I am just meeting, who are saying, yeah, well, I'm going to be like a thoughtful employee at this company, and I'm going to hold them to that. And I'm going to like, I know that, you know, just because they sign my paychecks doesn't mean that they're like an infallible company and that the work I'm doing here is going to be good, but I'm not going to be responsible for taking advantage of farmers, taking advantage of consumers, creating false marketing, putting something out into the environment that's not safe, or creating a product that isn't backed by science that I trust. And in my mind, like, you know, regulations are important. Changing companies, you know, policies and principles are really important. But the only way to make all that stuff stick is to have people on the inside who believe in that stuff. And to me, that is the most, you know, that is the thing that is becoming transformative, is that people are coming to work in agriculture, not just on like fun, tiny, sustainable farms or in little ways, but are striding into supply chains, striding into retail, striding into seed or chemical or these other big places, and saying, I'm smart and capable and an asset to this company, and I'm going to hold them accountable to doing better. And to me, that's a super hopeful story.
There's also been a change of president in the US since we spoke. What are your thoughts about the Biden administration's approach to ag and tech and climate change?
Yeah. Biden is not actively rolling back environmental regulation, worker regulation. You know, President Trump, as he was leaving office, held wages for farm workers in the H-2A program constant. You know, that kind of stuff that happens right at the end of a president's term is often overlooked, but can have like long lasting effects that are very detrimental to the industry and to workers and to so many different people. But it's exciting that we have a new president. It's exciting that he is so focused on climate change and having a different kind of conversation. And that industry has really been cognizant of that, I think, and is really kind of turning in a way to see that. But the Biden administration is still doing a lot, especially at USDA, still spending a lot of time just trying to unwind some of the problematic, like, you know, the family food box program at USDA was a gigantic garbage fire. So, you know, I think the focus on climate change will be good. My biggest worry, I will say, is that the Biden administration is going to move too quickly into a carbon market. I think the USDA has a role to play in establishing a standard, just like they have a role to play in establishing a standard across agricultural commodities. But if USDA goes straight to having a bank or setting controls on things, I think that will be, one, it will cement in place a program that, as long as it's still controlled by the private sector, is agile and able to move and change and develop in ways that it really still needs to, because the science is not ready yet. And yeah, and as soon as the USDA gets involved, it's stuck, right? It's frozen, because whatever the policy is just like how people will change their businesses and build their whole systems around exactly how the USDA program works. And the USDA isn't ready to build a program yet. So I'm hoping the Biden administration is hearing that feedback that I know a lot of people are telling them. I hope they are not rushing to send money out the door to provide this feedback. I hope they're thinking, they're spending time being thoughtful about how they can be a regulatory party first and not a market creator first. You know, obviously I would love to see USDA just ramp up some regulation, maybe not EPA's role, but, you know, put some, let's all decide together how farms should operate in a way that is not actively, you know, you probably shouldn't be able to sell carbon credits if you're an emitter. So maybe let's help farmers stop being emitters, and then we'll be so ready for the carbon market. It'll be great.
You know, Sarah, it's amazing how many roads seem to lead back to carbon. It's been such an incredibly popular topic on this podcast.
Yeah, and it's because it's such an entirely new space and opening up new revenue streams, especially for farmers, but also agribusinesses and big corporations in this space. And even though it's early, we do actually have to act quickly if we're going to move the needle on climate change, which ultimately is what it's all about. We're looking hard at the evolving tech landscape, and actually through our firm, Tenacious Ventures, have made a couple investments in this space, like Regrow and Nori. But we really wanted to include a corporate venture perspective too in this episode. So we brought back Derek Norman, VP of Venture Investment at Leaps by Bayer, another one of our really popular guests.
Yes, I remember the episode well. It was about 18 months ago. It was done as a live event with Tim Hammerich, who's the host of the Future of Agriculture podcast. And Jim Chambers from Trimble was in it too. So does Derek talk about carbon too when you spoke to him this time?
Yes, actually he does. And a lot of other exciting innovations in ag tech that are kind of coming out in this space around emissions reduction. Actually, he started the conversation though with how much the COVID-19 pandemic, as horrible as it is, has actually sped up investment in ag tech.
I think looking back when we spoke originally, it was still sort of fairly early in this new era of COVID and sort of just changing the way we work. And I think one of the big questions then, I think for all investors, was sort of how that would continue. I think we all had investment pipelines at that time that were, you know, at fairly mature stages, and you could sort of see how you might move things that were in the end of that pipeline through to completion. But then after that, it became a little less clear. I think that was a big question mark. But I think now if you look back, I mean, obviously, I think everybody's talking about just the investment pace is extremely rapid. It hasn't slowed anything down at all. And I think if anything, it's really increased. There's, I think, many reasons for that. I think one of maybe partially it's because there's no obligation to visit companies. And now it's coming back a little bit, but for a long time, it was almost impossible to visit companies. So in some ways just shortens the process. And then I think sort of an unintended consequence of people not traveling is, you know, sort of freed up everybody's schedules. So it actually made it easier to pace projects more quickly and to sort of follow up quickly. And so I think it's just that plus capital markets, right? There's just sort of plenty of capital flowing, the stock market's done well, and sort of everything has trickled down. And that extends to the venture capital markets, where there's sort of a strong appetite to continue investing and taking risk. Coupled with, sorry for the longer answer here, but then I think, you know, I think everybody now realizes, like, looks at big, you know, sort of dislocations that can happen. And we live in a very nonlinear world all of a sudden. So you look at COVID, and then you might extend it to other things happening in the world. And so there's also very big problems that face us. And I think there's absolutely a greater awareness of it. Not just awareness, but sort of a feeling of taking action by entrepreneurs and investors.
There's a whole conversation there, but I will move on. So you,
sure.
Leaps has a focus on tech and innovation that, as you mentioned before, reduces the environmental impacts of agriculture, that kind of mission focus that we're seeing more interest in the space. I've also heard you talk about, you know, paradigm shifts as kind of a concept. What are some of the paradigm shifts you're excited about and any of the technologies or specific startups, if you can say, that you think are kind of leading the way around these major paradigm shifts in ag?
Sure, I could think of a couple of projects, but maybe to run through, you know, we've actually announced a couple of investments recently in an area that there are, you know, there's many companies, I think, taking approaches here and approaching the problem differently, but in the field of nitrogen fixation. So we've announced an investment in Sound Agriculture and in a company called Andes Agriculture, and they each have quite complementary approaches to sort of solving the problem of helping crops produce their own nitrogen rather than requiring the use of synthetic nitrogen. I think each of them, right? So there's obviously the paradigm in this case is the application of synthetic nitrogen. So how do you move beyond that? There's many different ways you could envision it. So Sound is taking an approach of sort of developing essentially a bio-based input that can help the plants essentially recruit the microbes that are naturally present in the soil to fix nitrogen. So that's a really interesting approach. It sort of enables what's already there. And then the company, very interesting company, Andes Agriculture, sort of in some ways a complementary approach, but sort of they basically have a way of loading microbes onto a seed in a really efficient way that allows for very high colonization rates, that once again sort of allows for natural microbes that are found in the soil, although in this case they're pre-treated on the seed, to go on pre-colonize the plant essentially by being loaded at really high levels into the seed. But I just use that to illustrate there's many different ways of solving this challenge, and I don't think a one-size-fits-all approach will work across the globe.
One of the other things we talked about was digital agriculture and the difficulties we've seen in that sort of taking off are adoption challenges, returns challenges. How are you seeing the digital ag space? Is it getting more traction than a couple years ago?
That's been a challenging place for companies to scale, to really scale to tens or hundreds of millions of acres, which is the scale of agriculture. And I think there's probably many reasons for the challenges, but I heard a colleague describe it well recently, which is distinguishing between features and solutions. And I think that's been one of the challenges. And it's maybe not to criticize the development of features, because that's sort of the essence of a product, like the first stage, but the challenge has been the growers and the market is looking for this, sort of the whole solution. And often it's not a one-off feature or even two that will solve a problem, especially in sort of a complicated set of activities like agriculture. So I think, I thought that was a really helpful distinction and sort of helps diagnose part of the challenges in digital technologies gaining more traction. But one area, I think the thing that's different now compared to a couple of years ago, I think everyone was focused on yield, which is good, but it's an area of declining marginal returns, I guess, if you're going after, additional bushels per acre. I think there are other areas to look at, and certainly a lot of people have realized this, but especially with the advent of carbon marketplaces and the potential for growers to capture value through storing carbon or utilizing less greenhouse gases in their practices, opens up a whole new value stream for agriculture. But then that obviously is going to take a lot of different technology, which doesn't involve traditional agricultural inputs. And that technology does not yet exist. So if you just sort of look at the market size there of a couple hundred million acres and a couple of $10 to $100 per acre, depending on how much carbon can be stored, it's a pretty large market that really the technology is really in its infancy there.
That's something we've certainly seen in making this podcast, that there's a ton of interest and excitement, maybe even hype and skepticism around soil carbon. It's one of the most popular topics we've had on the podcast. It sounds like you're sort of bullish on this as an opportunity.
I think so. As a market, there's obviously so many questions, but that's always true of new markets, I think. But you start to get into carbon storage and thinking about what does that mean and how does it work on agricultural land? And it's sort of difficult, right? Because you have to think about time scale and organic carbon and its life cycle throughout in the geochemistry of the soil. Like, it's very complicated, very fast. And I don't think the science is quite up to being able to track that all. So then it gets a question of sort of how effective in some ways are those carbon credits, or do you focus on that versus greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, maybe nitrogen application and decarbonizing the inputs going into agriculture. So there's so many different ways it can go, but I think it's sort of a greenfield, no pun intended, for agriculture. It's a totally new value stream, growth area for the industry. Frankly, as a scientist or as an investor, it's interesting also because there's just so many different technologies or capabilities that could be applied to this space, from digital to inputs to looking at how you produce nitrogen to sort of how the plants are grown. So there's just so many different angles to pursue. I find that very exciting.
100%. No shortage of areas to look at in this space. Kind of changing gears a little bit, Derek, how do you see corporate venture arms like Leaps by Bayer fitting in with the broader ag industry or kind of big ag? And I guess where my head's going is, some of the big chem and seed companies didn't have amazing reputations 10, 20, whatever years ago, and there's still social license challenges around big ag today. Is that changing? And how do you see kind of venture's role in changing and shaping this conversation?
it's a good point on the social license, but I also say, you know, if you really want to have a huge effect, positive effect on the world, companies like Bayer that have a massive footprint, you know, Corteva, Syngenta, and other, you know, essentially, you know, since any large companies, actually are huge levers for change in a positive sense. And frankly, that's where they want to go, right? They may not be there today, but they know for the sustainability of their own business. You know, you look at what is Bayer's or Syngenta's or Corteva's business model look like in, you know, 20 or 30 years, it will be very different. And the kinds of solutions it sells or offers will be very, very different. So I see, you know, I see corporate venture and this particular Leaps by Bayer is sort of a bridge to help Bayer get from here to there, you know, taking advantage of paradigm shifting sort of breakthrough technologies that can solve problems for new markets. It sort of helps provide a stepping stone for a large corporation like this company to evolve into a different kind of business as the needs of society change over time. Otherwise, you know, society will leave the companies behind. So I think that's a key role of corporate venture capital. It's not just insight into the future, but it's sort of strategically sort of setting up the company to be able to make the moves necessary to evolve its own business. Mm-hmm. And I just want to reiterate the point. I mean, I think companies like this with such a large footprint in the environment are actually great levers for change. So you think about nitrogen fixation, and if you could offer, even just through breeding, for example, like marginally offer a plant that's a, you know, maybe a few pounds less of nitrogen per acre, that would just have a fairly large effect, right? It's a thin effect, but spread out over a large acreage would be a, you know, pretty big change for the world.
It's really interesting to say that. I mean, I think I've told you this before. My personal journey into ag was through like small organic, you know, vegetable production in a developing country. And I came at this like, you know, Monsanto is evil, these big companies, you know, watching all the documentaries, and have ended up in a wait, time out. If we want to really change this system, these companies don't want to do anything that's bad for the world. There's a lot of smart, well-meaning people in there. And by the way, if they do something and make a small change, you can turn that ship, you can really change the world. So that very much echoes my personal journey. And to your point before, the kind of talent that wants to come into this space now and the opportunities at a big company, you know, a startup might only be hiring 5 or 10 people, 15 people, 20 people a year. The kind of scale at which we can get smart people into this industry is unparalleled with big companies. When you look at ag tech and ag and kind of the next 5 years, what's most exciting for you? What's really going to move the needle?
One thing I have been thinking about recently, you know, synthetic biology buzzword. It's more than a buzzword, right? It's a whole bio revolution that's happening, just a combination of confluence of so many trends and discovery. So truly the pace of life science discovery, I'd say, is at least an order of magnitude higher than 10 years ago or 20 years ago. And that's because of access, obviously, to genomics. You can sequence individual plants or humans and really get a massive amount of data that gives you a lot of scientific insight. We obviously want to engineer living systems, I think, to help solve some of the greatest challenges in the world, but a lot of that is being applied to microbes because it's easy, right? I mean, it's easy to transform E. coli and manipulate them, and we're learning a lot about their metabolic systems. Plants are much harder, right? If you compare, like I would say, like the synthetic biology of plants is still more or less in the dark ages compared to where we're at with microbes. So that's just sort of a problem I'm thinking about. And no solutions are obvious or apparent today. But if you sort of break down the problem of why can't you do all of these things you do for sort of high throughput engineering and microbes, how can you do that on plants? I think is sort of an interesting question to think about.
Some great points there. You know, I think what has been so good about making this podcast is being able to follow the journeys of innovators who come from all different backgrounds and then just see where they end up. And I have to say, you, Sarah, have been on a bit of a journey of discovery with this podcast. Now, I've only been with the team for a bit over a year. So I wanted to ask you, why did you want to start AgTech So What in the first place? We're glad you did. I've got a job out of it. But why did you want to start it?
Yes. And I have to thank you too, because one of the things that's been so great for me about making this podcast is having you on board to help. So thank you for all your work behind the scenes. But I really started the podcast and we did as a company and a team because there were so many untold stories that I was hearing about and meeting people that are really just sometimes non-traditional innovators or folks kind of flying under the radar that I just thought were worth telling the stories of and kind of shouting them from the rooftops. And really, then it gave me an excuse to talk to them and to share those stories with other people. Given I love podcasts and didn't want to do anything with video, I thought it was maybe a good chance to do that. But we've come a long way, not just changing the name of the podcast, like you said, but taking on a bunch of feedback from our listeners to hopefully improve, which we really appreciate. One big one was our audio quality. Another big one has been our intro and of course our name over the years.
Well, as I promised earlier, I found some of the original intro. It's from 4 years ago. It's the music. Here it is.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Bush Tech, an ag tech podcast that gets to the so what of ag tech. We'll bring you interesting things from interesting people. And I'm one of your co-hosts, Simon Mathewson.
And I'm your other co-host, Sarah Nolette. On this podcast, we will bring in leading speakers in technology, entrepreneurship, investment, agriculture, science, and anything else you can think of and we can find in the world of ag tech. We'll look to demystify it so that we're getting to the so what. What does it really mean for farmers and for the broader agricultural industry?
I'm farming and I grow it. I'm farming and I grow it.
Sarah, it's all part of the iteration process you talk about.
Yes. Well, and part of iterating is failing and apparently being embarrassed. So thank you for that, Cadence. We also lost a bunch of the early episodes, but actually I think maybe that's okay because the audio quality, as our listeners constantly told us, was pretty crap. But really the best thing about the podcast is you, the listener. And so we put a call out asking you to tell us about yourself, what ag tech you've tried, or which ag tech industry you're involved in, and where you see the future of this industry going. And this is what you said.
Jonathan Zettler with Fieldwalker Agronomy in Ontario, Canada, and really enjoyed the Ag Tech So What podcast, mainly because you get your listeners, like myself, to ask better questions as we try and explore this space. And for myself this year, looking for remote sensing technology within this agronomy business, and it's enabled me to invest a percentage of my revenue and maybe take some calculated risks to try and identify that. But the podcasts that I've enjoyed the most focus on how to properly frame the problem and then look for solutions that address that. And keep up the great work. Really enjoy it. Thanks.
Hey guys, hey, my name is Marek. I'm a founder of a small startup based in Brisbane called Terrano. We are makers of long-range soil moisture sensors. So obviously the irrigation topic that you recorded was of particular interest to me. And I can't agree more with what you've described as the psychology of the farmers that's basically stopping the adoption of those new technologies. We'll be trying to approach them in exactly that way. So instead of trying to focus on technology and how good our devices are, we're basically looking at solving the problems and just proving that we have something that they will potentially need and it will make an impact, a measurable impact on something they own. So thanks again, guys. Keep up the good work.
Hello, this is Nick Seymour from Farmo. We are an Australian ag tech company trying to solve problems on the ground for producers with ag tech. The question posed in this podcast is, where is ag tech going in the future? In our opinion, it's going exactly where you want it to go. Ag tech is simply another tool in your toolkit to save you time and save you money when you think you could be better off doing other things. For instance, if you're like me and you hate getting a call from the Cavendish cop to tell you you've got cattle on the road because the solar energizer has gone down after a few cloudy days, well, you can get some ag tech that's going to send a message to your phone with it whenever the voltage drops on your electric fence line. One thing we haven't been able to do is invent a time machine, which is unfortunate because one of the worst things we have to do in the agriculture industry is just drive these long distances with hours and hours of boring miles in the car. And for that, we are very thankful for the technology of podcasts. And today we're celebrating the AgTech So What podcast reaching 100 episodes, which is an enormous achievement. And so well done. It makes our driving these long distances just that little bit easier.
So great. Thank you, Nick, Merrick, and Jonathan for those messages. We so appreciate you taking the time to do that. And Kirsten, thanks for joining and for embarrassing me. And again, for all the hard work you do to make AgTech So What possible.
My pleasure.
And a big thank you to our guests, Mark Wooten, Stu Austin, Sarah Mock, and Derek Norman. And of course, thank you for listening. As always, you can find all the resources mentioned from this episode on our website, agtechsowhat.com. And as a reminder, you can also go back into the catalog of episodes and listen to the original interviews we did with today's guests to learn more about them and how the space has changed. They have been some of our most popular guests for a reason. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. And if you like what you hear, please tell your friends about us. I'm Sarah Nolet. Catch you next time.